This is They Create Worlds, episode 206, Sega Saturn, part 1.
If anybody wants to find me, I'll be in the last place you would look. In a place where people used to be, a land that's called reality, you'll find me there.
Welcome to They Create Worlds. I'm Jeffrey, and I'm joined by my co-host, Alex.
Hello.
Today, we are going to have to go deep into the nether regions of the dark, black ocean void that is space, and go explore this little planet called Saturn. But first, I must regale you with tales. Wonderful tales. Because if you're listening to this when it comes out, you have a scant, barely 4 days to take advantage of a book. Not just any book. A They Create Worlds book, made by our own Alex Smith for a mere nominal fee of $25. This gets you not just Alex's book, but a plethora of other books as well. Not only that, you'll be helping charity. Everyone likes to help charity, so you get to feel good about yourself, spend a really small amount of money, get a ton of digital books, and you get Alex's thing, all for the low, low price of $25 United States dollars.
Truly a deal that would make Big Jeffrey's book emporium proud. However, this is coming to you from Humble Bundle. And it is indeed They Create Worlds, the people and companies that shape the video game industry, Volume 1, available for only $25. That's the amount you have to pledge towards the bundle to get the book included. As many of you are aware, my book usually goes for way more than that, $70, $80 range. So this is $25 for a 600-page book. $70 is a lot even for a 586-page book. $25 is a steal for a 586-page book, if I do say so myself. So if you've been holding off on the book only because of the price, which is totally fair, that's not a price I set. It's a price that was necessary to go through this publisher, and this publisher gave me the freedom I wanted to write what I want. So, I mean, it was necessary, but I totally understand. It's not where anyone would truly want it to be. If the price is what has held you back, this is your chance to buy it. And you can split your donation, so to speak. If you haven't done Humble Bundle before, they allow you to choose the split that goes to charity and that goes to the author. Obviously, I am always happy if you want to throw a couple of bucks my way. I mean, I would never say no to that, but I want to emphasize, I did not write this book to make the money. I wrote this book to help advance the understanding of video game history. So I am far more concerned that it is read than that I am collecting paltry royalty checks for it. So while this is self-promotion, obviously, and it's my podcast, so I can do that, it's truly not about the money. Give me some money, give charity all the money, I don't care, but this is probably the best opportunity that'll come along for some time to get this book at really a bargain for the content as opposed to for an exorbitant amount. There you go.
You don't just get that book, you get other books too on top of it, so check it out.
Exactly. We will, of course, have the link for that in the show notes. You can also find it by going to Humble Bundle's website. It's the Taylor and Francis, which is another label of CRC Press. It is the Game Architecture, World Building, and AI by Taylor and Francis. Despite the name, there are several video game history books in it, not just mine, as well as several books on game design. So truly a great deal. Look for that on Humble Bundle's webpage or check out our show notes.
Also, in addition to that, Alex and I have done something horribly entertaining for all of our loyal patrons.
That's right. Thanks to our good friend, Carl Kuris at the Video Game Newsroom Time Machine, who's really the person that drove all of this, we are starting a monthly hangout for patrons. Now, as I always do whenever we do something on the Patreon, I do want to emphasize that this in no way replaces the podcast or puts any of the podcast's material behind a paywall. Just as I did not write the book to make the money, While we are incredibly grateful for all the wonderful support we have gotten on Patreon, we always want this podcast to be free because we really want to help establish a greater understanding of video game history and kind of establish a better narrative of video game history than came out of some of the older books by Kent and Sheff, some of which are good, some of which are less good, but none of which were really advancing the story of the industry well. So the podcast will always be free. That is our pledge. And if that ever changes, you can, you know, send us this soundbite and write us nasty letters, as people do. But it is our intention that the podcast always be free. But we have been trying to figure out other ways to give something back to our patrons, because we are very, very humbled and grateful for all the support we have gotten for the podcast. We have started a joint monthly hangout with the Video Game Newsroom Time Machine with Carl, where we hang around, we play some games, we talk about the games as we're playing, we make fun of the people that are playing, especially if it's me playing. Believe me, I was never the game master. Just kind of generally have a good time, and patrons are welcome to hang out. Now, we kind of stealth launched because turns out February is short, y'all, and it kind of snuck up on us. We stealth launched this at the end of February. It was a little ad hoc, but it was still a good time. I think everyone had a good time. In the future, it'll be a little more planned. We'll announce it further in advance. Carl announced it 2 days before the event to his patrons. We announced it earlier the same day of, which will not be the way of things going forward. It is also possible, we're still working out the details, it is possible that we are going to create a tier for this, our very first one, and restrict it to $5 or more. Now, we're still happy for those $1 donations. If that's all you want to give, if that's all you can give, please go ahead. You will always have the podcast and you will always be supporting the podcast. But this feature might end up being a $5. We didn't want to make it too high, but we did feel since we were putting in a little extra time, it made sense to test this out. There you have it. That is kind of what's new in the Patreon world.
You got to see me play video games on a keyboard poorly while Alex and Carl made fun of me.
Now, your punch-out run was pretty impressive.
Anyway, I think it's time to get into that spaceship and go orbit Saturn or something.
Yes, so, Jeffrey, I am very excited about this episode. I mean, video game history is my passion, so I am, to one degree or another, excited about every episode of They Create Worlds.
They're all of our little children's.
That's right. This one I am truly excited about because we are going to tell a story that, in my opinion, has never been told before accurately. And that includes, I have to admit, by They Create Worlds itself. Yes, while we haven't done an entire episode devoted to the Sega Saturn before, which is what we are doing today, we did do an episode pretty early in the history of the podcast at this point on the struggles that Sega was having in the 1990s. And of course, Saturn was a part of that. Most of that episode still holds up just fine. But at that time, the true details about the Saturn with the all-important Japanese perspective from CEO Hayao Nakayama, Executive Vice President Shuichiro Irimajiri, Head of R&D Hideki Sato, were just starting to come out in English. We were just starting to get a sense of what their perspective was. We had only had an American perspective, either the perspective of the Sega of America executives who weren't really involved in most of the decision-making, or from the magazines at the time reporting on this that were often just as content to report rumor as fact as they were fact as fact. That has led to a problem with the narrative of the Saturn story, especially since that narrative is so convoluted. It involves so many teams against other teams. It involves conflicts with Sony. It involves last-minute hardware changes. It involves a complex hardware. There's a lot of stuff. I may have said in the Dreams of Sega episode, one of my, if you take just one thing away from this episode statements, in this one case, and as far as I know, knock on wood, this is the only case of this so far. I mean, we've made plenty of other errors, but I believe this is the only time where I've said take away one thing from this episode, and it turned out to be a lie. I said that they did not add a second processor late in development. Well, the spoiler alert, they did. More on that later, but I've been wanting to set the record straight for some time. I finally felt I had enough information just about the time that we did our two-parter on Sega's relationship with CSK. So I didn't want to do another Sega episode so close to that, just because we do try to spread out our topics a little bit. But now enough time has passed since those episodes that I'm very excited to take this deep dive look at the creation of the Sega Saturn and kind of the factors that led it to be this incredibly beautiful disaster.
Are you sure you just didn't lay the groundwork for the mistake there so that you can constantly mine this plethora of knowledge known as Sega? Because every time we drop a Sega episode, they are inevitably our most popular episodes.
That's true. They are pretty popular. It's a company that still has a passionate following, particularly in the Western world, both the United States and across the UK and Europe. And it's an interesting topic. It's definitely a company that kind of flew too close to the sun and got burned, but left a lot of people a lot of good memories on the way. This is one of their more difficult chapters. And, you know, 5 years, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, we might look back at this and say once again that we got it all wrong. Because that's the thing about history that we like to say on They Create Worlds, that it sure does change a lot for something that already happened. But this is going to be better than what's out there right now. I mean, for example, and not to throw any shade, because these editors were just doing what they could with the resources they had available, Sega Saturn is a featured article on Wikipedia, which means it's been recognized as one of the finest articles and it's well-sourced and all of this. As of this recording, obviously Wikipedia can change. As of this recording, what's on there is, well, some of it is right, some of it is very, very wrong. And again, that's just because it's wrong everywhere. Including, as I said, on a previous episode of They Create Worlds. I'm not just being that person without sin casting stones. Believe me, I can stone myself on this one too. So very excited. That's probably enough preamble. Let's jump into this story, Jeffrey.
All right. And I'll send a note off to Ethan to get your cell ready in the Department of Corrections. Bonus point if you get that reference.
Indeed.
Where do we start off in our massive look at Sega in order to get to the Sega Saturn? We had the Sega Genesis. We had them going, oh, we need to start developing a new console, but we need to add some more time. Let's throw on this 32X. Let's add on this Sega 3D. Let's add on this Tower of Power in order to create this monstrosity of a console that should transform into some sort of attack robot or something. I don't know.
It forms Voltron.
Let's condense this all down into a Sega console and let's call it the Saturn.
You know, that's kind of sort of what some of the narrative around the Saturn and the 32X has been. That narrative is also somewhat mistaken. To kind of set the scene here, I do want to pull back a little bit. Some of this will be stuff that we've talked about before, whether it be in one of our previous Sega episodes or in our episode on the crash that wasn't. But we need to pull back for a second and really focus in on the true uncertainty that was going on in the video game industry circa 1993, which was kind of right in the heart of Saturn's development. They started developing it in 92, but 93 was kind of the heart of development. This was probably the most technologically confusing time in the history of the video game industry. Computer technology, digital technology is always moving forward, of course. We have Moore's Law that tells us this and has so far pretty well held up. It's getting a little creaky at this point, but for decades and decades, it held up. So, of course, technology is always advancing, changing, morphing. Every generation of console is different than the one that came before. Every generation of a computer technology is somewhat different. But this period was especially fraught. From the very beginning of the mainstream popularity of video games, not talking Pong so much, I'm talking about Space Invaders. I'm talking about the Atari VCS. The video game was primarily, obviously, there are exceptions, was primarily a 2D sprite-based visual medium. Over this period of over a decade, that is what defined the video game industry. The sprites got prettier, you got more of them, you could do nice background tiles, you could add parallax scrolling. You could do particle effects and all of this other stuff.
Layering.
Yes. But at the end of the day, that was the medium of video games. It was a medium that was starting to lose its shine a little bit. This is the crash that wasn't. We won't go into that entire thing again because we did a whole episode on it. The kind of headline of that is too many companies had gotten in that were making too many games that were just too similar, not only to each other, but to the games that had come out on the 8-bit systems, like the Nintendo Entertainment System, the Sega Master System, before them. It was a somewhat similar situation to what happened in the great video game crash. I would say that, I mean, I don't know if I really want to say this, but yeah, I mean, overall, I think the companies understood the market better, so the overall quality of games was better. I mean, obviously, you can find stinkers on any system. But the medium had not really advanced very much between the 8-bit era and the 16-bit era. Take something like Super Mario Bros. 2, Yoshi's Island, to take something from near the end of the 16-bit era. Now, obviously, that's a great game, and it adds some non-linear elements, and it has these beautiful graphics that are very stylized. But how much does it really add over Super Mario Bros. 3, if we're being honest? Is it prettier? Of course it's prettier. Does it add some things? Yes, but how different is it really? How different is Mega Man X2 from Mega Man 2?
More story.
Yeah, but it's the same kind of gameplay being done in the same way. And yes, the sprites are prettier. They have more colors. They have shadows. The animations can be more elaborate. All of that. But the medium has kind of stayed still from the late period of the 8-bit era into the later period of the 16-bit era. At the same time, there is a revolution in computer graphics happening across multiple industries, not just video games, though it is starting to happen in video games as well, particularly in the arcade. 3D graphics research goes all the way back to the 1960s, with the University of Utah being one of the real epicenters of this. Obviously, this was being done on big, expensive computers with big, expensive custom peripherals and expensive custom software, and all of that barely lets you draw a 3D tea kettle. As with any technology, it takes time for it to mature. But then in the early 1980s, you started getting new chip architectures that were advanced enough that you could start creating more powerful computers that were closer to a personal computer than they were to a mainframe or even a mini computer. This was a category of computer called the workstation. The workstation as a concept basically doesn't exist anymore, and that's because PCs and Macs, you know, just personal computers, have become so powerful now that you don't need this special designation for this kind of weird in-between computer. You might have computers you still call workstations, but it's not the same as it was back then. It's not really its own category. It's really just a more powerful PC.
I would argue against this, and that it's only because of where I work and how I do the industry stuff. There is a subtle differentiation between a desktop workstation and a desktop regular PC. In a workstation environment, they usually go to this point of they have to render such complex models, especially 3D models, that you actually have almost like mini server CPUs inside of the workstation. It has everything put together specifically to run a really high-end 3D graphics. Now, is that line blurred to the regular PC? Yeah. Can I run a lot of the same software on my regular PC? Oh, yeah, definitely. I really think that there's still a differentiation there, but it is very, very blurred.
Exactly. And that's the point I'm making. Not that there aren't still computers that are called workstations, but that it's very hard to tell the line between a top of the end PC and a low-end workstation. There's very little difference anymore. But back in this time period, these used to be, it was as big a category difference as like a mainframe and a home computer. Like this was its own gigantic category when it first started. dominated especially by Sun Microsystems. But another early player that was very influential was the company Silicon Graphics. Silicon Graphics is going to play a minor role in our Sega story in a little bit, as we'll see, but I'm not bringing it up because of that, and I'm not going to do a full history of Silicon Graphics, but basically, Jim Clark, who was one of the people that hovered around the computer graphics program at the University of Utah in the computer science department, and one of his grad students, together created a new chip called the Geometry Engine, which wasn't quite a GPU, but it allowed for the offloading of a lot of the computation for complex 3D renderings from the central processing unit, and therefore was a breakthrough in being able to create polygonal graphics for a somewhat reasonable cost. We're talking about a reasonable cost for a corporation, not a reasonable cost for the individual consumer, but still a somewhat reasonable cost. And they founded the company Silicon Graphics to market high-end workstations making use of this geometry engine. Long story short, over the next decade, the company becomes very enmeshed in Hollywood and in the special effects industry. Silicon Valley and 3D graphics get a lot of buzz as their workstations are used to render incredible effects in movies like The Abyss, Terminator 2, and Jurassic Park. It's the true dawn of the CG industry. I mean, there was CG being used in movies going all the way back to the early 80s, but again, it takes time for this to mature. And kind of that trifecta of the two James Cameron movies, The Abyss and Terminator 2, and Steven Spielberg's Jurassic Park were kind of the signal that this has truly arrived and 3D graphics are going mainstream. So you have this going on. You also have another thing that we've talked about before, which is that another area, obviously, that has always been very involved in 3D graphics is the military-industrial complex. Companies that are creating simulators, particularly flight simulators, for the military to train their troops. So a lot of advancements had been made in 3D graphics in that space, and then the Cold War ended. So you now had these big companies like General Electric and Lockheed and Evans and Sutherland, founded by the two principal people at the Utah Computer Graphics Department, that suddenly needed to find new clients for their products. You had Silicon Graphics, a company that was growing and needed to continue to grow, that needed to find new outlets for their products. Yes, they're dominating this high-end workstation space in like movies and whatnot, but where else can they dominate? So you have these 3D graphics companies turning their attention to the video game industry, amongst others, at the exact same time that the video game industry is in desperate need of something new and more exciting, because it's clear that we've solved the sprite-based game. I'm not saying there haven't been amazing advances since then or amazing sprite-based games since then, especially in the indie scene. But it was getting to the point where all that was happening was a bunch of companies were just releasing retreads and slight variations, and the public was truly losing interest. You can see our episode on the crash that wasn't for more information on how that was playing out in kind of the 93, 94, 95 period. In addition to this, of course, you have multimedia and the very, very first stirrings of the World Wide Web that are telling us that there is a new future in interactive content that is going to involve advanced audio and video, not 3D graphics, but video, real people and places, and connecting with each other over networks. And that's kind of this whole other thing coming in. There's this idea, is multimedia going to bring this into the mainstream? Can we move beyond video game systems into something that plays video games? Yes. But also is of interest to mom and dad and maybe even grandma to like check their email or will help little Johnny with his schoolwork in addition to being his form of entertainment. This whole idea of the set-top box or the multimedia machine, things like the Philips CDI or the 3DO. So you have this weird confluence coming, and the companies in the video game industry have to figure out what the heck they're going to do with all of this. the declining interest in current game types and current games, the arrival of new graphics technologies, the arrival of new interactive technologies. You also have things like virtual reality that is starting to become sort of mainstream for the first time. We did an episode on VR if you want to look at that. The simulator idea that I talked about is not just about bringing these kind of graphics to the home, but it's also about all the other stuff that comes with a simulator. Making mechanical contraptions that move you around and pitch you around and make you feel like you're actually flying. You know, full simulators, not just the graphical element. It's an incredibly confusing time. And I really think, while every period of video game history has had its uncertainty, I really do honestly believe this may be the period of more technological uncertainty than any other, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. And I would also contend that this is actually the first time that they had to really transition truly console generations in a way and really try to figure out what does that mean going forward. Yeah, we sort of lucked into it with the transition from 8-bit to 16-bit, but that was a lot of people really just copying the big leaders and just going through as things were rebuilding after the crash.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't going, okay, now that we have these things and we have more powerful versions of these things, how do we look forward indefinitely?
Exactly. Now, Sega, of course, is in a unique position vis-a-vis its main competitors, Nintendo, who obviously dominates the industry, though has lost ground in America, and NEC, which is not a big deal in the United States, but is actually the second most successful company after Nintendo in Japan. Sega is the third place company in Japan. But they're in a unique place compared to those competitors of theirs, because they are also in coin-op in a major way. Nintendo had been, but they've been out of it a long time. NEC is a computer company. They were never in it. So they are experiencing this wave coming. We've talked about this in other episodes. Their arcade teams are starting to work with 3D graphics. They make a deal with General Electric to use their technology. Nakayama, as we talked about in our Dreams of Sega episode, sees an opportunity here, as does his arch rival in coin-op, Masaya Nakamura at Namco. They both see an opportunity here, as we've talked about, to fundamentally transform the arcade, or the game center, as you would call it in Japan, into a full-fledged amusement park, where you have elaborate games, full simulators, and games that allow 20, 30 people to play at once on ginormous screens and all of this other stuff. They're envisioning a new path forward. We talked about in some of our Sega episodes how the Game Center in Japan has always suffered from a poor reputation, even as it's been popular, and that there had been various efforts to rehabilitate the image of the Game Center. Turning the Game Center into an amusement park, a concept, I mean, everyone likes amusement parks, but in Japan, they particularly like amusement parks. Turning the Game Center into another form of amusement park, just an amusement park centered around high technology, feels like a really exciting thing to do. Nakayama, there are several profiles of him in this period, including the New York Times, that make it clear that his goal is to be a Walt Disney, or have Sega, more accurately, be a Walt Disney Studios. That is driving an uptick in the creation of polygonal games in the arcade, games like Virtua Racer, Virtua Fighter, Daytona USA. So one might think, okay, Sega is in the arcade. Sega is already dialed in on Polygon. Sega is already making polygonal games. Surely this is the company that is going to lead us all into some kind of 3D promised land. Well, not quite. Because there is something very important that we have to remember. As I said at the outset of this little dialogue, for the entire period of mainstream popularity of video games, the video game industry, and especially the home video game industry, has been a 2D sprite-based medium. There is nothing at all the same about creating a 2D sprite-based game and a 3D polygonal game. A 2D artist, the most brilliant pixel artist in the world, could when sitting down at a workstation for the first time and having to draw lines and connect vertices and figure out a Z positioning could be completely and utterly lost. Can some people do both? Well, sure. But there are a lot of brilliant 2D artists and animators that have no idea how to do 3D. And even if it turns out they have the talent for it, there's still a steep learning curve because they've never had to do it before. The process is completely different. There is no skill transference, essentially, between doing sprite-based art and polygonal art. The programming is almost as bad. Because, yes, it's all math at the end of the day, but once you add a Z-axis, the math gets a heck of a lot more complicated. And you're pulling out your trig now, buddy. You also have to figure out things such as priority, because these early systems don't have what is called a Z-buffer, which is basically creating the depth space of the image and keeping a record in memory of where all the objects are in relation to each other in terms of depth. So not only do you have to do all of this mathematical calculation for 3D objects and rotations and all of this stuff, you also have to make sure your program is keeping track of which objects are in front of other objects. And at this early state, the hardware is not helping you. Do Z-buffers exist? Of course. Are they too expensive to put into a home video game console? Also, of course. This is completely new, and it's going to leave almost everybody completely and utterly lost.
For those of you out there who might be wondering, okay, I sort of get what you're saying, but what's just to stop someone who's a 2D artist from just saying, okay, in the 3D space, I'll just lock this perspective and just go from there? Yeah, but you're kind of losing out on the other dimension of what you can do with 3D.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever played Doom with one of those Foley 3D articulations that you can do from your perspective, you can just see that all of the monsters and players and everything are all just cardboard cutouts moving around. They don't have any kind of depth to it.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing, too, is what you bring up with the whole collision thing. Also, sort of like Magnavox suing everyone about an object bouncing off another object, ultimately, video games involve objects colliding with other objects. In a 2D space, that is really easy, simple to do. In a 3D space, you have to take that same slice and bring it down all the way. Then you get into the whole calculus thing because, well, how many of those slices do I do in order to represent my object enough so that I can have it make sure that I don't have some sort of neutrino thing going on where someone shoots a laser at me and it doesn't collide? How do I do that? That's where the whole thing comes in. Okay, we're effectively creating a wireframe here. That is, here is our hitbox. This is our wireframe hitbox for this object. And to simplify this, for many 3D things, they make it simple shapes. Cubes, cones, some sort of combination thereof, sphere, and just be like, okay, if you penetrate this sphere or something, then we have a collision. The computers are so weak at this point that they're spending all their time just drawing the image, let alone doing the calculation to see, for frame one, object is at point A. Object two is at point B. Frame 2, object has moved. Did they collide during that time of frame 2? No, yes. Oh, but while we were doing that calculation, we are now 5 images down the line here. And, oh, darn. On frame 3, we were supposed to have a collision, but now the laser blast is way past. What do we do now? Crash! Crash! Panic! It gets really, really complicated, and this is where just having engines comes in. You wonder, why do we care about the Unreal Engine? Why do we care about the Godot engine?
Mm-hmm.
Why do we care about all these other engines? They solve all of that for you so that you can focus more on, I just want to put an object here and see if it collides.
Exactly.
I don't care about the math. I don't care about rendering the pretty pictures. I want to put my spaceship here, shoot lasers at the asteroid, and not have the lasers go through the asteroid.
Exactly. And at this time, there just wasn't anything doing that. I mean, you could create your own game engine, of course, but there was not a lot of sophisticated Z buffering going on, and it's just very complicated. So when Hideki Sato was looking at the state of the console industry, as he began to think about what Sega would do as a follow-up to the Genesis, he was obviously very aware of what was going on with polygonal graphics, because it was going on metaphorically just down the hall in the arcade division. But he also strongly believed that the companies in the industry, the programmers, the artists, the organizations in the industry, were not ready. So he made the decision that while the Sega, what became the Sega Saturn, was going to have some ability to do 3D graphics, its primary goal was to be the best sprite driver that has ever existed to this point in a home console. That was the goal. And it was a goal eyes wide open. New 3D was coming, but didn't think that it was ready for prime time yet because nobody was going to be able to do it. So focus on sprites, put some 3D capability in there so that by the end of the console, perhaps some interesting 3D stuff would be going on. But it's going to primarily be a sprite-driven console. Now, having said that, Hideki Sato, and I should say at this point that a lot of the information, though not all, of the information I'm going to impart today comes thanks to a gentleman named John Harrison of the website MD Shock, who speaks Japanese and has both translated some of these Japanese sources or excerpts from them. Also, though, just by virtue of doing some of this translating, has made me aware of sources that I wasn't aware of before, that I was able to machine translate even more than he hand translated. So this is where we get a lot of these new perspectives. Sato did an oral history with a Japanese university, and so we have a lot of his perspective now on the creation of these systems. So when I say Sato believed this or Sato believed that, I am not speculating. This is what Sato actually said in his oral history. Now, he could be lying or misremembering, that's always the case, but this is not speculation on my part. This is truly what Sato was thinking. Hideki Sato looked at the state of the video game industry, and he knew that a next generation system from Sega was going to have to do something groundbreaking technologically. It wasn't going to be 3D graphics, because the world just wasn't ready yet. They were going back and forth a little, but it was looking like it was going to be their first system with a built-in CD-ROM drive. However, in Sato's words, that wasn't enough, because even though it's their first with a built-in drive, they've had the Sega CD and NEC, and their PC Engine has had a CD drive even longer than that. It's not exciting and new. He needed some kind of hook that was going to make this console more interesting technologically. What he finally focused in on was the RISC processor. So we've talked about this before in other episodes because it's come up before. So I'll just talk about this briefly here. But RISC stands for, it's an acronym, stands for Reduced Instruction Set Computer. Basically, it is a streamlined architecture with less functionality than what one might call a standard processor. So though at this point, I think a RISC is a more standard processor than a CISC. But at this time, what you would call the standard processor at this time, a CISC processor, which is a complex instruction set computer, It has less functionality, but it's more efficient. So there are pros and cons to it. One of the big pros is the lower cost, because if you're implementing less stuff in hardware, you're using less silicon, then obviously your production costs are cheaper. The other thing is that it is very efficient at what it does. It is more efficient at what it does than a comparable CISC processor. So it's really good for tasks that require high speed, like, say, rendering video games. Now, there can be drawbacks in speed, too. Because it doesn't have as much functionality built into the hardware, if you try to get it to do something that isn't part of its instruction set, then you need more instructions in software that slow it down, because something that you could just pump right into the hardware of a CISC, you have to do more code, and so that can be a slowdown. But for the things it's specifically designed to do, it can be more efficient. In everyday life, I guarantee you just about every device that you use now has a RISC processor. Your PC doesn't, because one of the big things about that whole Wintel environment is that we need to maintain full compatibility with all the programs going all the way back to the first PC in 1981. So you can't change over from a CISC processor to a RISC processor in the PC space without blowing a lot of backwards compatibility, and nobody wants to do that. Outside of that, though, just about every device you have, I guarantee, has a RISC processor, including especially your mobile phone. We've said this on other episodes, but that ARM processor that is in all the phones, that is short for Acorn RISC Machine, because the company Acorn Computers invented it, and then the R is for RISC.
If I recall correctly, most RISC systems, especially around this time, what they discovered is that there's certain gates, and a gate is a logic gate, is what I mean by that, where I take two inputs and I get some sort of output. And then you can chain those together in order to get different things. You have things like an AND gate. If I have A and B are both yes, then my output is yes. I have an OR gate. If A or B are yes, then I get my yes. Long story short, what you can do with these NAND gates is actually create every single other gate based off of it. This makes things really, really cheap and easy to do. However, you have to implement a lot of gates and wire it in weird, fiddly ways in order to get that complexity that you want. The same thing applies when we're talking about a complex chip versus a reduced instruction set chip. Yeah, that complex one can do all of these cool features and stuff, but the reduced one can do all of those little things really, really, really quickly, but it might have to do all those really quick things so many times that it just adds up to a state of, hey, I'm having to recreate the wheel here when the complex one already comes with wheel. Another way of thinking about this is high-level programming languages versus a low-level programming language. Yeah, assembly is really, really efficient, but yeah, it's really hard to work with and really small and fiddly and really efficient, and I have to write all of these common, easy-to-do things. But if I'm playing with a high-level language where all I have to do is just do drag-and-drop things, yeah, I can't do anything super complex from my end of what I want to do that it can't do, but it's a lot easier for us as humans to understand. I will, of course, throw some computer science-y stuff into the show notes, and if you want to delve more into this insanity, I encourage you to check it out.
Absolutely. There was not unanimity within Sega that moving in this direction was the way to go, because there was also a contention, particularly in America. Now, they didn't have direct say over what the next console would be, but they would still provide their perspective. Wanted to use the Motorola 68040, which was basically a 32-bit update on the Motorola 68000. This would have been a traditional CISC processor, but it would have been familiar to those who had worked on the Sega Genesis, and there would be the opportunity probably to introduce some backwards compatibility with the Genesis as well if they went the 68040 route. So there was some debate about this. But at the end of the day, Hideki Sato decided that they really needed to make some kind of technological splash, and this was the way to do it. The other thing that he wanted to do that was technologically interesting is take advantage of a relatively new, at the time, form of memory called synchronous dynamic random access memory, or SD-RAM. Again, the thing that set SD-RAM apart from DRAM was efficiency. The synchronous comes from the fact that it is synchronized with an external clock, the clock of the system, of the CPU. As a result, since it's working very much in tandem with the CPU of the system it's designed for, it is more efficient and faster than standard DRAM. Of course, everything these days is SD-RAM, but back then it was brand new. this was another opportunity to make a splash. Now, not all of the RAM in the system was SDRAM, but they wanted to include some SDRAM. You can see here they're including a more efficient type of processor, a RISC processor. They're including a more efficient type of RAM, SDRAM. Both of these things are specifically very good at doing processes that have to be done very quickly, like, say, generating a sprite-based world. A 3D world as well, of course, but we're not talking about fast enough CPUs or incorporating enough very expensive RAM to do that necessarily efficiently. But this is the exact technological route that makes sense to go if you want to make the best sprite-based machine of all time. Because basically you're saying, what are the bottlenecks in doing this really, really fast? The processor and the memory. Okay, I mean, there are others too, but for this little exercise, the processor and the memory. So, okay, let's go and unlock the potential of the processor and the memory by turning to these new technologies. So that was kind of the whole raison d'etre for the Saturn. In terms of the processor to use, they were really honing in on NEC. They were going to use NEC's RAM. NEC was not the inventor of SDRAM, but they were one of the early companies to have a chip. And they were looking at using their processor as well when they were visited by and also ran in the RISC space, Hitachi. Hitachi had recently completed its first RISC processor for mass production, the SH-1. Which entered production in September of 1992. Quite frankly, they were not able to find any clients. They went out, they tried to sell it. People were like, oh, this is very interesting. And they just were not getting any offers. Finally, as basically one of their last chances, they had already been working with Sega, trying to convince them to use a different architecture of theirs in their next console. So finally, as kind of a last act of desperation, I mean, it might not have been the very last place they went, but it was certainly not the first place they went either. They decided to make a visit to Sega headquarters by the Haneda Airport and pitch them on using the SH-1 in their upcoming console. So they met with Kazuhiko Hamada, who was actually the person in charge of the hardware design. You know, Sato is overseeing all of R&D, and he's the big picture guy. Kazuhiko Hamada is the hardware engineer that's leading the hardware design. They have a meeting. It doesn't go well, but they are sort of interested in looking at this further. They do have some requirements. This is according to an article that was written back in 1997 by one of the Hitachi engineers and was one of these things that was translated by John Harrison. Again, this is why we're getting some of these interesting new perspectives. Sega did have some requirements. Of course, they had already decided that they were using SDRAM, so they needed assurances that the SH-1 was going to work well with that. And they also needed some benchmarking to be done to make sure that it was really suitable for a game system. What they discovered is that the SH-1 was not ideal. Now, I'm not a technical person. I know I say this a lot of times. So my apologies if I get some of this slightly wrong or use some of the wrong terminology. But my understanding from reading stuff that was written by people that do actually know something about this technology is that there was a slight problem with the way it handled instructions. The SH-1 processor, or I think they were just calling it the Super H processor at the time, because the S is for super, and there was no SH-2 yet, so I think they were just calling it the Super H at the time, but retroactively it's been called the SH-1, is a 32-bit processor, which means it operates in 32-bit word length. But its instructions are 16 bits wide. But it works. They basically had an architecture in there that allows it to retrieve two instructions in a single cycle. which means even though it's only drawing 16-bit instructions, it's doing it so efficiently that it's pulling two of them at essentially the same time, boom, boom, so that you effectively are able to transfer 32 bits of information across a 16-bit bus through dark magic. This is not how RISC always works. I mean, yes, RISC is always trying to be efficient, but this was actually a response to a common problem with the way that RISC designs were back then, where there would be errors because of the efficient ways that they were trying to do things. And this actually, in some way that I don't know very well, because I'm not a technical person, corrected for that. However, because of the way that it does this, there is some slowdown in how it reads instructions. It's inevitable. I mean, it's black magic. At the end of the day, it is still passing 32 bits of data through 16 bits of pipeline. Sega was intrigued with Hitachi's designs, but the Super H itself was just still too slow for what they were hoping to do. What the two companies decided to do is they actually went into business together. Hitachi agreed to create an upgraded version of their Super H processor specifically for Sega. Now, they were also going to sell it on the open market, but the only reason that they were creating it was for Sega to use in their game console. And that is what became the SH2 chip, a RISC processor that is slightly more efficient in ways that I fully admit I don't understand than the SH1. So they're using Hitachi for the processor. They're using NEC for the memory. Things are starting to come together. In terms of how the graphics work on this thing, they include two chips called the video display processors, or VDPs. Now, these are not full GPUs because the vast majority of the calculation is being done by the processor. Processing is not being offloaded to the VDPs, but the VDPs are drawing the screen. So once the calculations are being done, to my understanding, again, I'm not a technical person, but once the calculations are finished by the CPU, then the actual rendering of the graphics is offloaded to the two VDPs to create the frame buffer or whatever. Each of these chips has different functions. Video Display Processor 1 draws sprites, and these sprites can have geometric transformations. You can manipulate and distort them and do all of this with them. This is also the chip that does the faux version of 3D that the Saturn is capable of doing. The Saturn is weird in that its 3D objects are not formed by triangle primitives. They are formed from quadrilateral primitives. The reason for that, to my understanding, if I'm reading the tech right, and I always caveat that because I know I'm not a technical person, the reason for that is that their polygons are basically just sprites. The sprite engine in this is able to join sprites together at any angle. You don't just have to put them side by side by side. You can put them at a 45-degree angle to each other, a 90-degree angle to each other, etc. So the reason they're quadrilaterals is basically they're just attaching one sprite to another sprite at an odd angle, to another sprite at an odd angle, and poof, you have a three-dimensional image. I know it's weird. It's supposed to be weird. Nobody does this, but does that even make any kind of sense? I know it's weird, but does this seem like something that is real?
I can sort of see this. What I was imagining in my head as you were describing this is, let's take a plane. I have a plane of paper. I want to create some sort of weird, vaguely sphere object. We'll say that that only has so many sides, but it's not going to be truly smooth. What I can do as I'm rendering that is I can have them join together with another square that's at a 22-degree angle, then another 22-degree angle to the end of that one. Then it goes all the way around in the giant ring. Mm-hmm. Then once I got that ring done, I can take it and move it on the Z-axis at a 22-degree angle and then build a ring around on the Z-axis. And then I have two rings together that's sort of starting to form my sphere. Then I can take more of these squares and fill in the spots in between. And then I have something vaguely resembling a 3D object.
Mm-hmm.
Yay! Like you said, is this efficient? Yes? No? Maybe? I don't actually know a lot of the technology of how 3D works. I know that triangles are used for a very specific reason, sort of like NAND gates, where they can do everything with a triangle if you're weird and clever enough.
Right, because, of course, two triangles together is a quadrilateral. So it's like it's a more efficient shape because it's half the shape of a quadrilateral in a way.
Arguably, they could have just pushed the same thing instead of having, you know, sprites be squares or quadrilateral. Sprites are all triangles that we build together.
But that doesn't work on a CRT television that thinks in square pixels is the problem there.
Yeah. And then where do you go between the whole pixel thing and the quadrilateral versus triangle? And it gets complicated and weird.
Yeah.
I will try to find some stuff to try and explain some of this a little bit better than this. And if I do, I'll throw them in the show notes. I make no promises on this one.
Jeffrey's thinking to himself, these show notes are going to take 20 hours.
Pretty much, yes.
20 hours. This is a more deep dive technical episode than we often do, especially since I'm not a tech person, but you cannot understand why the Saturn was what it was without getting into this. Why is it only kind of able to do 3D? Because Sato and the Sega team figured people weren't programmers and artists weren't ready for it. Why does it use quadrilaterals to do its kind of 3D? Well, because since they weren't going full 3D, they basically cheated by turning their sprites, which have to be quadrilaterals just because of the way pixels on televisions work. They have to be quadrilaterals. They turned their sprites into their polygons by connecting them at angles that are not just like 180 degrees. I want to say that a lot of the technical detail that I am getting is from the phenomenal website, and I do not use that term lightly, the phenomenal website of Rodrigo Copetti, who has done in-depth technical breakdowns of several generations worth of old consoles, including the consoles of this generation, like the Saturn. We will put his website, Copetti.org, Copetti.org, in the show notes, because I'm sure I'm only explaining this barely resembling correct, and I wouldn't be able to even get that far without using Mr. Copetti's websites. Big shout out there. That's the VDP-1. VDP-2 specializes in rendering large planes. In other words, backgrounds. Its specialty is generating the backgrounds as large bitmaps, 4096 by 4096 bitmaps, that also can have transformations applied to them, similar to some of the Mode 7 style transformations in the SNES, like rotations and scaling and all of this. It can also render tile-based backgrounds on the fly. It doesn't have to put them in the frame buffer. There is a frame buffer on the system, but the VDP-1 does all of the interacting with the frame buffer for the most part, whereas VDP-2 can do a lot of its processes without the frame buffer. So those are kind of the big things that the VDP-2 does, is a lot of the background. And it also serves as the interface between the VDP-1 and the frame buffer as well. So the VDP-1 is connected to the VDP-2, and the VDP-2 is connected to the VRAM, and the VRAM is connected to the red thing, and the red thing is connected to my wristwatch.
Uh-oh.
As always, bonus points if you get that reference. So what we have here is a central processor, the SH2, that's doing all the calculating, including the calculating for generating the graphics. We have these two VDP chips that are then taking those calculations and actually throwing the graphics up on the screen, with the VDP1 primarily doing the sprites and the polygons, and the VDP2 primarily doing the backgrounds. Though I'm sure there's some mixing and matching there, but that's some of their primary. There's also an SH1 in there, because they needed a separate controller for the CD-ROM drive, because the SH2 is too busy doing all of these calculations that it can't spare any attention to the CD-ROM drive. They also throw in an SH1 from Hitachi for the CD-ROM drive. When you put all of these things together, you have what they hope will be one of the coolest sprite-driven video game systems ever made. Then, in the summer of 1993, Sony publicly unveils its PlayStation. Maybe not to the public, but to the development community. The Sony PlayStation is designed from the ground up to be a 3D system, because it's coming from a company with no baggage in the industry. Sega is thinking about the poor developers, both their own developers and the developers at the other companies, and how they just aren't ready for this yet. They're stuck where they are in the industry. They're having a bit of a vision problem, but Sony has no vision problem because they are not of the video game industry.
Sony is of the Walkman.
Yes. They don't see the limitations. They only see the opportunity. And Ken Kutaragi, the father of the PlayStation, he discovered a 3D architecture that a division of Sony had created to create, like, graphics for things like television stations. Like, you know how, this is Channel 5, Action News, and then there's some big logo flashing across the screen, you know. Sony created a system to do those kinds of graphics for television. And Ken Kutaragi saw that, and Ken Kutaragi was interested in video games. And Ken Kutaragi was like, I bet I can adapt that to video games. This is not a PlayStation episode. We'll do one of those someday. So I don't want to go too far down the road to the creation of the PlayStation, but the point is, Kutaragi saw a future of 3D, and so he created a system that was designed entirely to do 3D. In fact, it has the opposite problem of the Saturn, and I won't go into the technical details, but the PlayStation basically uses polygons to do its 2D graphics, so it's actually really cruddy at doing 2D sprite-based type stuff because its technology is entirely focused on doing three-dimensional stuff. I mean, you can put textures on your three-dimensional spaces, obviously, and those are sprite-based, but, like, it's not meant to have 2D objects moving around. 2D textures only. However, that wasn't a problem because Kutaragi had no intention of pulling people along through the old 2D space. He was going to tell people 3D's the future, get on board or get out. Sega couldn't bring themselves to do that because they were stuck in the industry. And Sato was correct that this was going to be a huge shift for people. I mean, he wasn't wrong about that. But he was being a little too, he and his engineers were being a little too protective, essentially, and were being a little too cautious. So this PlayStation is revealed, and Sony says it's going to be able to move 300,000 polygons a second. When it comes out, it's really capable more like half of that, because it's 300,000 before textures, before lighting, before particle effects.
That is the hard upper limit. Sort of like, yes, you do have a phone that has 4 gigabytes of RAM in it, but 2 gigs is used automatically for the system. You really can only play with 2 gigabytes of RAM.
Exactly. When it actually came out, this was not true. However, this still absolutely scared the shit out of Sega, because it looked like a very real 3D future was here, and the Saturn was not equipped for it. Could it fake polygonal shapes using its VDP processors? Sure, it could. Did the SH2, which remember is doing all of the actual calculating, strong enough to do that for a lot of polygons at the same time it's doing everything else it has to do? No way in hell. So there are not a lot of good options here, because this is late. This is late in the game. This is the middle of 1993. The system is coming out hopefully at the end of 1994, and you have to have a lot of run-up. You have to have time to manufacture. You have to have time to give dev kits to developers so that they can make games. We're at the point where the architecture basically has to be locked. The most obvious and most natural thing to do at this point, with no limitations, if you have no limitations on your time, is to put a GPU, a graphics processing unit, in the darn thing. Offload from the main processor all of that complex graphics processing. It's what we do in our computers today. They would have loved to do that, but chips take a while to develop, and we don't have a while. A GPU is out. There's no time to make one. But it just so happened, and this was completely coincidental, this had nothing to do with anything that Sega had requested. Just so happens that Hitachi designed the SH2 so that you could link it with another SH2 and have them function in parallel. So Sega came back to SH2 and said, can we put another SH2 into this console? Hitachi said, yes, we can do that. If you take only one thing away from this episode, it's that the Sega Saturn only had a single SH2 processor in it until the PlayStation was revealed, and at that point, they put in a second SH2 processor. And don't let anyone, even debonair podcast hosts that do deep dives into video game history, tell you any different in any forum.
At least until some other future episode where we find that all of this is bunk and we have to start all over again.
No, this is true. We have this from both sides. Hideki Sato has said this in interviews, and the Hitachi engineer that was part of the development team has said this in interviews. This is rock solid, unless they have been conducting a disinformation campaign for the last 25 years because they are sick and twisted individuals that just want everything in the world to be wrong. This is truly correct. We have corroboration from multiple sources from multiple companies.
Okay, so truth as long as we are not in Bizarro universe. Got it.
Exactly. At the time, and I believe this is wrong, at the time, the Western game magazines reported that Sega added a second graphics chip to the system. I think this was just either lost in translation, misunderstanding, whatever. Because, first of all, no one's ever said that. Sato's never said they added another graphics chip. You know, nobody said it. It's just something that was reported at the time by those Western magazines that, like I said, did not always have the greatest access to the Japanese devs and were as likely at times to print rumor as they were to print fact. If you look at it technically, the way the VDP processors work, that doesn't make sense at all because they were always designed to work as a team. VDP1 was for sprites. VDP2 was for backgrounds. There's nothing in that architecture that looks like it was sloppily slapdashed together at the last second. I am as confident as I can be. There's still slight room for doubt there, so we're not going to make this if you take just one thing away. We're not going to go there. I believe it was designed to have two VDPs all along, because those VDPs are both doing different things, and that's nothing new. Like, the Atari 8-bit computers used two different chips that worked in tandem to do things graphically. The Amiga computer used multiple graphics chips. These aren't GPUs, but they're graphics chips. Used multiple graphics chips that were designed to work in tandem. Like, this isn't a new concept. So it's fully believable that from the beginning they decided that they were going to have two VDPs that were working together, taking on different parts of drawing the graphics. So I believe those news reports at the time were getting confused about the SH2. But we do know, and we really do now, know that this second SH2 was added at the last minute because they needed more processing power so that the system could actually do 3D games. Though it's still better at 2D.
But not with triangles, but with squares and polygons.
That ship's already sailed, because that is entirely down to the architecture of the VDPs, and they aren't changing those at the last second. They're just adding in the second SH2 that is serially linked to the first so that it can handle this. We have an architecture now, Jeff, and I think that is probably a great place to stop right now. We've thrown a lot of technical spaghetti at the wall trying to see what sticks. I think it's probably safest to stop there. So in our next episode, we will move from the conception of the system to how it was received internally within the company and how that led to a massive schism between Japan and North America that results in the birth of everyone's favorite add-on, the 32X.
Okay, well, I should have known better. Alex talking the distance between Earth and Saturn. So obviously, now that we're just getting close to Saturn, we're just going to have to do our flyby and figure out how we turn this monstrosity around to go back to Earth.
You know, I wasn't really expecting this one to be a two-parter. Naive, I know. But we do one-parters sometimes. I do think it's so important to get this story right, because, or as right as we can with current sources, because it has been told so wrong in the past. And I really want to hone in on this system, because this is a pivotal moment. It's the moment Sega dies as a hardware company. It takes a few years for Sega to realize it's dead as a hardware company, but this is the point it dies, and it's worth examining that in some depth, especially since it's been covered poorly in the past.
We'll see you next time on They Create Worlds, the Space Saturn Adventures. Check out our show notes at podcast.theycreateworlds.com, where we have links to some of the things that we discussed in this and other episodes. You can check out Alex's video game history blog at videogamehistorian.wordpress.com. Alex's book, They Create Worlds, The People and Companies That Shaped the Video Game Industry, Volume 1, can now be ordered through CRC Press and at major online retailers. So really get it through the Humble Bundle if you hear this when the episode goes live. A lot cheaper, $25, and you get more books. Email us at feedback@theycreateworlds.com. Please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/theycreateworlds. Please help get the word out by leaving a review on your favorite podcasting service. Intro music is Airplane Mode by Josh Woodward, found at joshwoodward.com/song/airplane mode, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Outro music is Bacterial Love by Roland Music, found at freemusicarchive.org, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License.